week. We've had earnings disappointments, right, from the likes of Apple, Amazon, a soaring dollar, rising rates. The markets barely budge. We get one piece of news that gives Donald Trump an edge over Hillary Clinton, and the markets react immediately.
In the short run, anything could happen. Right.
I would argue that this week the market got actually pretty good news in terms of global economic data, GDP numbers for the third quarter, granted backward looking.
If the Russell starts rolling over like it has been, maybe based on rates going higher, I don't know. But I don't think the S&P can be far behind.
The biggest challenge for stocks are those long-term bonds. That's the competition. And I think what it is people are coming to the conclusion, yeah, the Fed is going to hike.
I think you have to buy all interest rate sensitive stuff. I think you have to buy utilities again. I think you have to buy gold again. I think you're entering into a world. I want the safety plays again. You're not going on risk if the overall market is selling off.
These are the things that I think are going to be vastly improved upon if Mr. Trump becomes president of the United States. People are catching on to that now. They're realizing that's what's more important than just Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton.
It's a movement.
It's a fire.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, we got a better than expected number for the third quarter with GDP growth coming in at 2.9%. Of course, this is the first number that could always be revised. But nonetheless, it was a nice surprise for the market. Stocks up sort of mixed this week. We have a couple of indexes that are barely making their way into positive territory and some that are negative. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Robin Griffith will be joining us. He says it's time to get defensive. He doesn't like the way the markets look. He sees a global slowdown, and he is moving into a defensive position. He'll be joining me. Also, Dave Morgan will be joining me later on in the program talking about precious metals. Sort of a mixed bag there with what is going on with the commitment of traders. Dave will be here to tell us about it. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. It's amazing what central bank economists have been saying lately. Otmar Issing, the first economist for the European Central Bank, says the bank is becoming dangerously overextended and the whole euro project is unworkable in its current form. He's warning it's house of cards, which is going to collapse. And some parallel ideas have been spoken by William White, former chief economist at the Bank for International Settlements. He says the negative side effects of easy money are starting to grow. And at this point, central banks are doing more harm than good. Coming up in the second hour of the program on The Big Picture, Chris Sheridan interviews William White, former chief economist at the Bank for International Settlements. All of that coming up today on the Financial Sense News Hour. And Ryan Poplava, another week of, well, I guess, meandering by the U.S. stocks, right smack in the middle of earnings season. Seems like results have been fairly mixed, with a group of stocks doing well each day with great beats, but there's just as many as it seems that are disappointing. And one of the big ones this week was Apple. So what's continuing to cause the market to go sideways and not break down or up?
Well, John, the primary concerns have been who's going to win the election. We talked about that last week, and that's just right around the corner. So making, you know, huge bets when there's that uncertainty, who's going to win, which party, who's going to take control of Congress, and those things do affect business, and both have varying ideas, both parties, about the direction for the economy and plans for, let's say, just taxes. And, you know, Jim's discussed that at length many times already in the past few weeks. So there's that. That's one reason to kind of stay your hand from either a bullish or quite heavy-handed bearish stance. You know, companies continue to announce, as you mentioned, earnings. We talked about a little bit last week as we had just a slew of them come and announce. And the same thing this week. I think there was nearly about 180 companies from the S&P 500, 78% of which have reported positive earnings surprises. So that's a really good rate. And that's actually probably, we're looking at one of the best quarters since last year at some point. So things are looking up as far as earnings. However, like you said, there's been some mixed results. Even though they have great beats, they might be guiding down. And I don't have any measurements for the percentage of stocks and companies that are guiding down for the rest of the year. But we've definitely had those mixed results. Then there's rate sensitivity. You know, that's another item that has investors fairly cautious. And, you know, we've seen rate tantrums. We saw the taper tantrum back a couple of years ago. And now, you know, are we going to see a rate tantrum? So far, no. However, the markets are definitely adjusting. You know, you can see that in the treasury market. Yields are going up and up at new highs versus the last 4 or 5 months. So that's definitely, we're seeing some changes there. And as we're talking about rate sensitivity, where's that coming from? Central banks are reining in accommodation expectations, or at least they're trying to. We saw just last week, right? We talked about the ECB changing its language towards inflation for the first time in a long time. You know, there's still a lot of things out there that are affecting the market. Oil, 2 years ago when the dollar strengthened, oil started to have a hard time, commodities in general. And looking right now, OPEC had that agreement to kind of hold steady their production. And when we look at things right now, Iraq and Iran, well, you know, they met this Friday. They don't want to do that. They're saying, we're trying to ramp up production and you're kind of hindering our style. I don't know. That's coming out. And there was a lot of reports earlier this week about that. So we saw oil dip below 50. There was some economic news out of the UK, Germany, and the US that did help add some support around the middle of the week, as well as some mergers and acquisition activity like AT&T's plans to acquire Time Warner, as well as Qualcomm's official announcement to acquire NXP Semiconductor. So there's some pros and cons looking at the big picture. However, as long as, you know, we can continue to meander, as long as the central banks aren't aggressive in cutting liquidity, and we kind of make these small baby steps to adjust for that removal of accommodation, you know, I think we can meander along, as you mentioned, but definitely some uncertainties right now. The elections, once we get past that, we'll maybe have a little clearer picture. And also, you know, the economic news and results that we should see next week should be important.
Well, as we meander along, where would you say the strongest earnings growth so far on the meandering is based on the companies that have reported this season?
Yeah, as I mentioned last week, we can talk about the big S&P 500 index, but the index is made up of sectors. Those sectors are made up of industry groups. And there's, while one left hand might be not doing very well, let's say like some of the interest rate sensitive areas like consumer staples, those are having a hard time because as rates are going up, those high yield companies become less attractive, yet we still need yield. So with that said, there is an area right now that is doing well as far as if we're just looking at earnings, and that is energy. There were a lot of beats over the course of the last few weeks in total so far in the S&P 500. Most of those energy companies have been beating their earnings estimates by a decent margin, followed by utilities and financials. But if you base your question, John, just based on, you know, who has the strongest sales surprises, that would have to be financials.
Okay, well, you mentioned that there were some economic items this week that may have helped to stir the pot during the week and actually lend some support as well. What were you referring to when you mentioned that?
We did actually have a couple of major reports this week. There was the third quarter GDP figures from Europe. We saw UK's, Germany, and then we also had the US. But there was a report in the middle of the week. There was the market economics release of the US services PMI, and it made a decent jump right up to 54.8 from 52.3. And that kind of corresponds with some of the things we saw earlier this month in services from last month. So inside that release, they had mentioned the fastest upturn in new business volume since late last year. However, you know, if you really dig in to that report, they also mentioned that hiring kind of remained subdued in October. And that's, John, that's not a great sign for the jobs report due out next week. And, you know, if we have all this volume coming in, yet a hesitancy to really ramp up hirings, that's because maybe they don't think it's long term. Maybe it's just a short term blip, and we don't want that. But Germany's business climate index climbed to its highest level since April of 2014. That helped move the markets overseas. And then the UK reported better third quarter GDP growth, as was ours. On Thursday, it was announced 2.9% versus a year ago. But it seemed a lot of that increase was from inventories. If you dig into the report, for example, personal spending was down, and so was spending on equipment. If we're a consumer-driven economy, well, we want to see personal spending increasing, especially as we're seeing wage growth in this country. So we want to see personal spending go up. Basically, the third quarter GDP figures really went up. A lot of that was based on inventories. And a build there, as we've seen many times over the past 2 years, and beyond that, you know, inventories build, then they have to get worked off. So if they get worked off and we're not building to those inventories next quarter, that could affect GDP. Now, you know, we just have the holiday season. So hopefully there's enough demand so that companies don't have to discount hard, lower their profit margins. We don't want to see that. But based on the employment we've seen over the past couple of months, that may be an issue. We'll have to see here. Employment's been solid overall, but, you know, we've been seeing a deceleration in that over the past year. So again, this kind of all kind of corresponds with some of our feelings towards, you know, we're in that final phase of the bull market. So there's still some information there that's going to hold up the market, but we're not quite where we were 4 years ago. Just, I think, looking at these figures a couple of years ago, we're at, you know, 4% growth. We're not there right now.
But we continue to be in a trading range for stocks, but it's not the case in bonds. So should my worry signals go up anywhere on this?
You know, a lot of that, like I mentioned already, it's a lot of that's sensitive to what's going on with the Fed. However, you know, some of those positive economic reports are also having that effect. When you've got positive economic reports, typically yields go up in that type of an environment. And that money shifts over into growth areas. And I am seeing that technically. We're seeing a lot of growth areas that are performing, or a lot of pro-cyclical areas that are performing. But, you know, we've seen this adjustment period before in stocks, John. Each time the Fed has phased out one of its accommodation tools in its tool chest, like QE, as I mentioned, the taper tantrum a couple years ago, and then again over rates last year, you know, almost every week we were talking about, is the Fed going to go? Is this the month they're going to go? And, you know, finally happened in December. So far, high yield bonds are hanging in there. They weren't last summer. You know, high yield bonds were really suffering, and there was a lot of concern over China's growth, over Europeans' growth. That's not the case right now. And as I said, those high yield bonds are hanging in there. They've corrected a little bit, just like stocks have. They're supposed to both go in the same direction. So if we're meandering in stocks, you're going to see those high yield bonds meander as well. What I don't want to see is those crater. We don't want to see high yield bonds really fall off a cliff here. That would cause me some major worry. You know, you had three big money managers last week say they are cautious on investing much of anything right now, including David Tepper, Jeffrey Gundlach, and Carl Icahn. These guys have been fairly conservative in their approach to the market over the last year, especially in their commentary. We know many of them are short the market. So we took a similar approach as we began to wean off our bullish Kool-Aid at our financial strategy meeting last year. We've talked about that before on the show, that Poplava Financial Services believes that we're in this final phase of the bull market. How long can that last? You know, it's typically between 1 and 3 years. And our next annual meeting is just this weekend. And it very much has a similar theme. So we're not diverging way away from those major groups that I already mentioned, those managers, Dave Tepper, Jeffrey Gundlach. They're short. We're not short. We're not net short. We're net long this market. And you have to be cautious, however, when the bond market is weak and sensitive to rates. So, like I said, we're watching high yield, watching it very closely. If we see it roll over, that's going to have us concerned. We're going to probably raise some cash. You know, as long as the Fed continues to remain accommodative, that should help by gradually raising rates instead of being aggressive. And I think this year was a very good example of the Fed listening to the markets and the economy. Held off on, if you remember last year when they raised, they had anticipated raising it 4 more times this year. Hasn't happened yet. Although there's a good chance in December. Very good chance. Probability is pretty high. But, you know, please, just don't raise rates just so you can lower them later. You know, we've talked about that plenty. But at the same time, they know full well the market has adjusted too much and has grown too comfortable with low interest rates, living in a world of zero, a negative interest rate environment. And really, just as Jeffrey said last week, the days of negative interest rates are numbered. And, you know, we agree. Obviously, clearly, rates are headed up right now.
Good report this week. Looking for a big week to report on next week. Probably not so big on earnings, but I would guess there's going to be a lot of economic news. So we'll look forward to it. Have a good time at the seminar this weekend as well.
Thanks, Sean. Will do. And I can't wait to meet some of our listeners. So we'll see some of you there.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Jeff Cotterman. He's director of National Association of Sports Nutrition. He's also the owner of TriSystem. Jeff, let's begin with you're a personal trainer. You're involved in all aspects of training, from not only exercise, but also nutrition, diet. Let's talk about why the combination of all three. A lot of times you'll see people, they'll go to a gym, they join a membership, they know they need to exercise to stay healthy, to keep their weight down. But let's talk about the combination of all three, because a lot of times people will go to the gym, but they're not watching what they're eating, or they're not getting the proper nutrition, and they really don't advance the cause.
Correct. I founded a system called TriSystem that actually addresses that. Most people will enter into a fitness or health plan, it'll be segmented, they'll get information from a book or a magazine about a certain workout or diet, and then they'll get their information somewhere else about a nutrition plan or a supplement. They'll rely on the clerk at the local supplement store, and their program is segmented. And in some cases, it works against each other. So what we do is we integrate nutrition, exercise, and supplementation. Exercise is the stimulus that causes your body to change. Nutrition is the resources to actually make that change happen. And supplementation is basically nutrients that can be timed and portioned specific.
Well, here we are in no man's land. Usually this time of the year, stock market is quite volatile. So far, it's been calm. But is it based on fundamentals, or is it central bank policy? Joining me on the program from Global Investments is Robin Griffith. And Robin, if we look at the bond market and we look at the stock market, they're telling investors two different stories. Bond yields are at record lows, the lowest that we've seen in history, and they're almost pricing a global depression. On the other hand, if you look at the stock market, stocks are almost pricing a boom, especially when you look at some of these multiples. So which side is right?
Yeah, they can't both be right. And it may well be that, in fact, they're both wrong. Asset prices are wildly mispriced. I mean, clearly, the theory about lowering interest rates is to stimulate the economy. But if a large part of your economy, the consumers, are at retirement age, they feel, I'm not getting enough on my pension or my savings, so I feel poorer. I spend less, not more. So it's had a sort of backfire on government policy. And actually, roughly a quarter of all government bonds around the world are now in negative interest rates. So when you lend someone a bit of money, a year later they come to pay you back, they only give you three quarters of what they borrowed. And that is not sustainable. But equity markets, I mean, both the British and the U.S. stock markets are virtually at their all-time high. And in the case of the U.S., the P/E ratios are very forward-looking, as you would get if there was a great boom ahead. Basically, all of the economic indicators that we look at, including some from the Conference Board, which are leading indicators, are all suggesting that the world economy has had a recovery from a ghastly period about 7 years ago. But in spite of a long, drawn-out recovery, it's still hardly firing on all cylinders. And in fact, going into 2017, it looks like it will be cooling back down again. Now, none of our indicators are saying that the strongest economies, which would include the US, are going to go into a depression. But they do look as though the economy will slow down to what we would call subpar growth. It would still be growing, but much slower than it normally does. Something like 1%, maybe 1.5% would be the sort of likely forecast for a strong economy. And for the course, in the matrix of all world economies, there are plenty that are in recession right now, mainly because their economies rely on selling a commodity, typically oil, and the oil price is nowhere near break even for these businesses. So this is a huge problem. And it's not just the US or UK problem either. I mean, it goes around the world. When you look at Japan, the Bank of Japan not only is the largest holder of Japanese bonds, it's also in 81 of the 225 stocks in the Nikkei index, it's the largest equity holder as well. So what we find, we're living in a new normal where governments or their central banks intervene in markets, both bonds and equities, and prevent the market prices being decided by the interaction of willing buyer and willing seller. So if they haven't permanently broken, they have at least temporarily suspended the capital asset pricing model. They've stopped capitalism working across the world. And okay, if you want to be a communist country, you can do that for a long time. But most of the world doesn't want to be communist. So this must be seen as a temporary situation. And at some point, we've got to get out of this and go back to something approaching the old normal. In the old normal, the rate of interest is usually and sustainable at roughly the speed that the economy grows, plus anything for inflation. So if over long periods of time, the US economy grows at, let's say, 3% or 2.5% to 3%, and you get a little bit of perfectly comfortable moderate inflation, let's say 2%, well, the rate of interest should be 4, 4.5, somewhere in that bracket. But if we were to suddenly jump the rate of interest on the long treasury bond from where it is now to 4%, the wealth destruction in the biggest and supposedly safest market of all would be such that it would crack confidence all around the world and we'd have a global wipeout. So we can't allow ourselves to go back to the old normal anytime quickly. I think that once a new president is in place, it's quite likely that the Fed would want to at least make a token gesture in the right direction whilst the US economy is at least relatively strong. It may not be super strong, but it's relative to other places in pretty good shape. Over here in Britain, we're clearly not going to get that because currency markets typically predict the economy really pretty well. And when sterling has just dropped roughly 18% in a hurry, in a flash crash, that's predicting the British economy is going down in the coming year. It's going to be in recession. Looking at the euro, Mr. Issing, who founded the wretched currency, he's saying himself it's a basket case. It's just a question of when it disappears, basically. So for the dollar to beat those two currencies and their economy to beat those two economies, that's not a terribly difficult thing to do. When we look elsewhere in the world, though, there are other economies that are actually growing at 6.5% to 7.5%. And of course, they're all in Asia or in so-called emerging markets. So China and India are the two big strong ones. Plenty of the other emerging markets are also likely to grow at quicker rates.
Robin, let me stop you there for a second, because one of the things that is perplexing a lot of investors, not just individual investors, but also hedge fund managers, is normally, you know, you can look at technicals, you can look at charts, you can look at fundamentals. But when you look at, for example, stocks, as we were just talking about, the economy has been slowing down. Corporate profits are down 5 quarters in a row. And yet, if you look at the historically low yields, you would say, who would want to buy them? So if you were to make rational investment decisions based on what you see,
it doesn't work out, because when you think rates are going up, they go down. And when you think stocks ought to be going down, they go up. So a lot of these seasonal deviations and cyclical factors have been squashed by central bank policy.
Absolutely right. I mean, when you backtest the data, it is one single month in any year, which is usually quite weak. It's September, coming out of a high in August into September, going to a low in October. Well, quite clearly, that hasn't happened this time around. It's been completely squashed. And as a sort of rule of thumb, government interventions can override the shorter-term cycles easily. Anything shorter than the annual deviation is easy for them to manipulate. But at least in theory, they can't override the longer-term cycles. And in fact, if you just plot the yield of the 10-year Treasury for the last 50 years, you're looking at a Kondratiev wave. From 1946 onwards, the yield on bonds went the wrong way and the cult of the equity grew. And then from about 30 years ago, the yield on the bond came back down again and the equities have been finding it going a lot tougher. That is one complete so-called Kondratiev wave. So that cycle is still absolutely there. Looking ahead, if it is indeed still a cycle, we ought at some point to be looking for the turning point of a generation where yields on bonds stop falling and start to go back up again. And of course, that would mean a new version of the cult of the equity, or at the very least, real assets going up and paper assets coming down. And now, plenty of people have been trying to make this call of the turning point of a generation. I mean, Mr. Bill Gross did it several times on the way down. I stuck my neck out in 2003 saying, this looks like the bottom to me. And for about 2.5 years, it looked like quite a good call, but ultimately was wrong. We didn't know then we were going to have the Bernanke era and all this quantitative easing, because we were going for what had been precedented in the past. And what we've got is something that's unprecedented. I don't think anybody clearly knows how we're going to get out of this. But if we look back at history, there's a thing called a jubilee. When every 50-odd years, different societies in the past have realized we've got far too much debt in our society, we're going to have to write it off or forgive it and start again with a clean slate. And the planet has got itself into one of these periods right now. Of course, there's no great agreement between all the countries of how we're going to write this debt off or forgive it. At some point, there are banks with what look like assets on their balance sheet, and they're going to have to admit, you know what, that's either worth nothing or it may even be a liability and not an asset. And I think the polite way of saying it, markets need a reset. Get back so that the prices can be rationally determined. In trying to be rational about why would you buy a government bond with a negative yield, you can be a little bit rational about that. If you're saying the government is actually guaranteeing me that in a year's time I will get 97% of my money back, that's quite good in an environment when your alternative investment, you're worried, might lose you rather a lot more money than that. So if you can guarantee a small loss, it's like paying an insurance premium. I'm going to get virtually all my money back if I buy a US Treasury bond or the UK gilt. And at least it's a sort of guarantee, whereas plenty of the other asset classes that I might speculate in, there's no guarantee attached to them at all. They might go up, they might go down, and I'm rather worried they might go down an awful long way. And this is the conundrum we've got. My cycle work, sticking only to the very long-term cycles, the ones that are most unlikely to be overridden by central bank intervention, has always pointed out that late 2017 would be likely to be a period when capitulation has taken place, and therefore it might be a market low. The period from 2017 till around 2020 is not likely to be a bonanza, but we could regard it as a stabilizing base-building period. And once we get through to 2020 and on, the demographics start to get extraordinarily favorable, what we're calling the millennials out there. They've got an awful lot of new technologies. Sticking to Mr. Schumpeter's expression, creative destruction, these new technologies will create whole new industries that may well kill off some old industries, but at least there'll be Western industries employing Westerners and growing our economy with that. So I think we can look forward to a great boom ahead, but we've got to get there from here, and that involves this reset process, which is likely to be pretty tough. And therefore, our advice is, at the moment, we don't want to take any risks that we just don't have to take, because markets are not likely to reward us properly for the risks that we're taking. So we've been recommending what you would call a barbell strategy. In the middle of the bar, which represents all asset classes, own nothing at all. And then at one end of the bar, where you absolutely want to guarantee, I'm going to get most of my money back, a U.S. Treasury bond or if British, a gilt. And at the other end of the bar, we do need some income. And we're going to buy equities of the type where, whether they're cheap or dear, these businesses are very survivable. Frequently, they've got a bigger market cap than countries have got. And we can't really imagine life without their service or product in our lives. So, and they'll pay some dividends. We don't know exactly whether they'll pay all the dividends we're expecting, but at least there will be a stream of dividends. And I've actually plotted on a chart how quality stocks are performing against value stocks. And it's quite clear that quality is more highly sought after than value. So what the charts are saying to me is a stock that looks as though it's cheap, or it's cheap for a reason, is jolly risky. And a stock that looks expensive, it's an essential company. So it may not look like a sort of Benjamin Graham type bargain, but we're pretty confident that business will be around and pay us some dividends. And when I then plot those quality stocks, they're basically matching government bonds. So our barbell has got government bonds at one end and the highest quality equities that'll pay dividends at the other end. And meanwhile, we do want to sit on some liquidity, and there's nothing wrong with holding some gold or silver, which is money. We don't want to hold commodities, though, because, again, the cycle work suggests that the low for the commodity cycle, which has had a monster bear market, will also come round about late next year. So it's late next year we could see a switch out of bonds into real assets, which would include equities and some commodity-related equities. But we're not there yet. You see, if the world economy is about to cool down a little bit, you wouldn't expect, well, the price of copper and oil is going to go rocketing up.
Let me stop you there for a minute, because one of the things that we're starting to see is, on a global basis, economic recovery remains subdued. In fact, a lot of the indicators look like, whether here or overseas, they're peaking and slowing down, which could lead to that reset you're talking about. But what do central banks do if that happens? In other words, in many places, when you're looking at Europe or even you're looking at treasury yields here, they're already low. Do they go lower?
At the moment, on our charts, there is absolutely no sign that the trend of falling interest rates is ending. We've had a little rally in yields, but it's no more than a rally in a continuing downtrend. Obviously, of all of the central banks, the one that's been talking we'd quite like to go the other way if we're allowed to is the USA, which has got a better case for doing that than anyone else. But even there, I don't think they've got the ability, no matter who wins the election, to go very far. They might do a 0.25%. The idea of going to get four hikes between now and 2016, just, it's not going to happen, basically. I would back away from any such forecast there. So there might be a token gesture. For example, supposing the election result is a landslide to Hillary, such the Democrats control both houses, the dollar rockets up and people rush into the dollar. That would be a sort of euphoric blip. But then I think the reality attack would be, yeah, but the economy is cooling down, the global economy is cooling down. Even in China, which is growing okay, they've got a debt problem and they've got to pay that back, and they'll do it, but it'll take time. We've got to get out of here. And so things will settle back down again quite quickly. At the moment, what my work is suggesting is the world equity markets have actually been in a bear market for the last 18 months. But because the US market is such a big constituent of the world index, you need to take the S&P out of the world index and then look at what's left. And then it's crystal clear the world's in a bear market. It's had an initial fall, a bear market rally, which is absolutely normal. And it's rolling over into the normal, the last leg of the best of the bear market, which is usually the one with the fear and the capitulation in it. When you then come back to the US and say, well, are we going to do a bit of that? You now come into the problem of, how is our index constructed? Is the S&P, or indeed the Dow, really representing America? And the answer is not terribly well. The S&P is dominated at the moment by between 5 and 8, no more than that, giant stocks, all USA, but all, you know, Google, Alphabet, these sort of companies, Facebook. Whereas when you look at the stocks that are more the backbone of the real American economy, Walmart, IBM, they're obviously in a bear market and had a rally. So to overcome this artificial structure of the index, you need to look at the New York Stock Exchange Index, which is all of everything. And then you get the picture much more clearly that actually we're in a bear market now. We peaked out and rolled over. And the question is, so will it be a big bear market or what you might call a common or garden bear market? And the rule there is you only have to fall a long way if you were in the stratosphere to start with. So those stocks where the multiple on them was really extraordinarily high. Nobody says the business goes wrong, but the share price multiple comes down. And there are plenty there that could allow for a 50% decline. Whereas in markets where the P/E is only sort of 16 or 12, what you might fall 20%, that'll be plenty. Well, a 20% setback is not terribly scary. History shows we have lots of them and we survive them just fine. In fact, we know enough about buying the dip. So in a thing as big as the US market, with its many constituents, it will be complex. And therefore, to speak in simple, broad brushstroke language, we just need to allow for that, basically. But I don't think we can get away without quite a nasty reset in prices. And once we've had the reset, the rate of interest can go up to what it would be in the old normal. But there will be wealth destruction. And because it's by market cap, the bond market is the biggest market, the biggest wealth destruction will be eventually in bonds, not in equities.
So, Robin, the message that I hear you right now, if you take a look at whether it's P/E ratios on stocks, you take a look at what's happened economically, and even what's going on in some of the bond markets like corporates, emerging market debt, and junk bond yields, you're not really being compensated for the risk. So the message that I hear from you is this is the time to start de-risking and getting defensive.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. There's nothing wrong. After all, if your government bond has a negative yield on it, cash in the bank isn't worse than that. And holding a block of gold isn't worse than that either. So in our models, although gold is not the strongest asset to own by any means, it's up there with quite good ones. And we should think of it as a form of money, not as a commodity. And to some extent, silver cashes in on that view as well. So we're owning a little bit of high-quality equities for the dividends, some government bonds, and some things like gold, but some cash is fine. Certainly, I think once the election result is out of the way and any euphoric reaction, I mean, early next year, I would definitely want to own plenty of cash because I would be expecting to be offered some bargains before this time next year, basically, somewhere in there. The other thing is, because we're now living in a world of flash crashes, central banks don't allow normal bear markets. So as Sterling has found, what you get is a sudden flash crash. In fact, when Sterling is down about 18% from its high now, but it did 8% of that in literally under 1 minute. It was in seconds, 48 seconds, it fell 8%. Well, that's a flash crash, and that's pretty scary. And I think many markets are vulnerable to that. All it requires is one day when no one's paying attention, there'll be enough marginal selling to trigger some algorithms on some computers to follow suit. You won't be able to look back and point at some event that happened. It just happens, as it were. And I'm afraid this is very dangerous, but this is the world we're in now. And therefore, we don't want to be caught in circumstances where we're vulnerable to an event we can't predict exactly. We just don't want to play that game. And just sitting on our assets and preserving their value is a good thing to do.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
We have a website called Global Investment Roadmap, GIR, and also they can come through the ECU group. So ecugroup.com will also click onto the GIR roadmap. And we've got, because our original product was designed only for enormous institutions, we have since created a product much more interesting and of value to private individuals. That's a new thing that we've responded to requests to produce. So that's there now from now on.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Weather plays a very important role when we think about the impact on commodities, on the market, on the global economy, various areas. And so to give us an update on what's going on with the weather, not just short-term, but also long-term weather impacts and the forecast currently, we're joined by James and Evelyn Garris, authors of the Browning World Climate Bulletin. And I want to say the last time we spoke with you, we discussed in the beginning this potential dramatic change that we might see from a warmer than average El Nino, which we had seen this year, to a potential colder than normal La Nina, and the impact that this would have, especially on commodities in certain areas. I understand from reading your most recent bulletins, it looks like there's been a change to that forecast, and now we're looking at perhaps a warmer than normal La Nina. Let's get into that and what took place just recently in the past few months that has changed that outlook.
Well, one of the things that's happened is the Pacific Ocean just hasn't been studying the models properly and hasn't been behaving like all the models said proper La Nina should. And the La Nina is when the Pacific cools off. And so initially, I mean, in mid-August, the majority of scientists around the world were convinced there was going to be a La Nina. And then by September, they changed their minds and started saying, well, no, maybe it'll be neutral. Maybe it'll be a weak La Nina. Heck, some of them even stopped looking for a La Nina altogether. Now we have the scientific community literally split between the Asians and the Americans. And what I have been finding, because our organization has to deal with worldwide investors and we talk with all the different communities, is it looks like there will be what is called a Central Pacific La Nina. What is that? That's when the cold is concentrated in the center of the ocean. And it has a much greater impact on Asia and Australia, and they get more rain, and it has less impact on North America or on South America. And as a result, we do not get the terrible droughts that La Niñas normally can bring. So it looks like because this is a peculiar type of La Niña, we will have a warmer than average La Niña that it will affect North America and our crops fairly weakly, but it will affect the Asian crops even more, especially in the areas where they plant things like soybeans.
Well, the precious metals are up on this Friday, not by much. They haven't been doing much of anything. Are they ready to explode as they normally do this fall? Or are patterns shifting? Joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, let's begin with gold because we hit a high in the summer at 1384 in July. Typically, summer months tend to be seasonally weak for the price of gold. And typically, as you get into the fall, as we are now, seasonality-wise, it tends to be a stronger run for gold going into the end of the year and the beginning of the year. So let's talk about gold right now. What's your take on it, and what are you seeing? And more importantly, what are the big boys doing on the futures market?
Well, Jim, you're exactly right on the seasonalities, and I'll start there. Historically, for the last few decades, it was pretty much, and it can be verified by data, that August would be the low for gold. The summer doldrums, a lot of traders had extended summer vacations, and you could pretty much yawn. In fact, the old adage, sell in May and come back after Labor Day, applied year after year after year. This year was a bit different. It extended into the summer, as you just mentioned. And now we're going into the fall period where normally in years past, you would expect a rally to take place. However, if you look at the last 4 or 5 years, what we have seen is a shift in the seasonality, which means that we were seeing the lowest price for the precious metals in the last trading day of the year. And it's very easy to manipulate, control, or move a market when it's a low volume situation, which is exactly the case when you're trading the last trading day of the year, because again, most of floor traders and off floor traders and big funds, et cetera, have left their work you know, week or two before that. So whoever remains is a very small subset of the overall amount that's normally trading. So it's pretty easy to place the price almost anywhere you want. So this is different and has been again for the last 4 or 5 years. Now, we must remember that last year, the low happened, I think it was either the last trading day of November or early in December, and that was it. And we got this rally into January, and that one has stayed pretty consistent. I used to trade a lot of platinum and palladium, and it was almost a gimme that if you bought into the futures or options or both into the other white metals, especially either one really, or both, you could almost get a guaranteed trade or lift into January. Now that's fairly true for the metals across the board. Doesn't mean that, you know, it's absolute. So I really thought, based on the low last year, that the January rally was almost a certainty. And of course, let all the Morgan Report members know that. And of course, we got this rally. And I thought, well, it looks like it'll go in April. And then I said, you know, that's good. And it looks like we could extend into the summer, something that's highly unlikely on, you know, probability. So that's point number one. Then you ask me, you know, well, what does it really look like based on the big boys with the commercial interest? Or let's go back to the root, which is the commitment of traders. I was asked, you know, by the members and outside in the public, you know, David, what do you see for the next, you know, few months? And this was back when we were hitting these, you know, nice numbers in gold in the 1300 plus range, as you mentioned, and silver actually touched around the $21 level for a few trades. It was in the high 20s. And I said, you know, it looks to me as if we could see the 1250 area for gold be tested and also the 1750 level for silver. And this was well in advance of the sell-off. And I kept warning everybody with my video updates for our premium members that the probability was very high, regardless of the markets trading differently and the open interest being extremely high and these small little corrections that were overcome and these orchestrated, what appeared to be orchestrated sell-offs failing two or three times, did not mean that it wouldn't succeed at some point. And the probability is extremely strong that we would get a takedown. So we have. Now the question is it done? And the answer, Jim, is I don't know. What I suspect, again, going with, you know, years of looking at this, is that we aren't done. We could get a nice rally in silver and gold, and we're already starting to see one. You know, gold's gone from the 1250 level I mentioned up to about the 1270 level. Silver's bounced up about a dollar or so. And it could extend. The election could have some influence on metals prices on a short-term basis. But I do not like the commitment of traders setup, which means gold has got to be decreased by about 100,000 contracts and silver probably in a 30 to 40,000 contract range. If those numbers were met on a sell-off or even in a steady state situation, meaning that the prices of gold and silver hadn't moved that much, but the commercials were covering that amount, I would be much, much more inclined to say, yeah, the bottom's in, safe to buy, you know, all clear ahead.
Dave, let's talk about two possible impacts on the price of metals. Let's begin first with the obvious one, the presidential election. It's less than 2 weeks away. Would the election of either candidate, a Trump or Clinton, in your opinion, alter the outlook for precious metals?
You know, Jim, I really don't think so. I know that it's contrary to a lot of what people write on the internet, but you're asking me for my opinion, and it's a studied one. Basically, at this point in time, the metals are a crisis hedge. An uncertainty hedge is probably a better word. And the uncertainty of what will happen with Trump is probably greater in people's minds than what would happen if Clinton is elected. But they're both an uncertain future. And I think that you might get a bigger rally temporarily with Trump. I'd favor that slightly. But really, you can't determine it ahead of time, in my view. And that I think on a longer term perspective, it's meaningless. I mean, I was asked this question at the Minds and Money show in Canada and Toronto, and I've given the answer, I think, once before that. And I said, to me, it's like changing the captain on the Titanic after it hit the iceberg. I don't think it really makes a lot of difference. Now, I really hope I'm wrong on that. I mean, Trump is obviously a wild card in most people's perspective. And what we don't know is what he will do. We know what he says, But we heard a lot of what someone said they would do when the Obama first election. I mean, you know, bring the troops home, most transparent government ever. A lot of these things sounded real good. And excuse my conspiracy here, Jim, but let me go for a moment longer. I think Obama was actually cut free and said, yeah, go out there and say whatever you want, you know, real change and all this stuff. And I think he believed it. Now, that's my opinion. It's just my opinion. But once he was elected or maybe selected, he went into the big room and the government above the government, known as the deep state or the shadow government by most of us, said, OK, great. Congratulations. And by the way, here's how it works. You're middle management. Now, that's my perspective. And thanks for letting me rant on that. So it could be where Trump is in office and then that same scenario takes place. And in the case of that situation, I don't know the outcome. I don't even know if what I'm saying is absolutely true or not. What I do know is that it's a high probability. And now we have to see, you know, what happens. Is it the walk or talk the talk? Does he get in there and all of a sudden start backsliding on, you know, what he had committed to verbally? I don't know. But I do know this from the time that you asked me to be on your program till now, the basis of what has gone on in not only the financial markets, but society at large has gotten to a point that I really didn't expect it to. In other words, the amount of disinformation, propaganda, and propping up the markets has gone to an extent that even I didn't think would take place. And yet I've been looking at this for four decades.
All right, let's move on to the next one, and that is interest rates. I just read a report. This is obviously coming from Wall Street, but mentioning that if the Fed raises interest rates a quarter of a point, which means the Fed funds rate would move to 0.75%, that this will have a huge impact on gold. And I just, Dave, I don't know, for the life of me, 0.75%, why would you avoid gold and go into a treasury? Because you could get 0.75%. So your take if the Fed raises interest rates?
You're absolutely correct, Jim. The only reason, and this is propaganda again, it's propaganda from the mainstream financial press. And they are trying to give the idea, which is correct in one context, and I'll get there, that higher interest rates are negative for the price of gold. This is true if and only if the interest rate is a real rate of return. So this is what happened in under the Volcker regime back in the late 70s or early 1980. Volcker came in and raised interest rates to, depending if it was a T-bill, T-note, or T-bond, anywhere between 18 and 20%. The inflation rate, CPI official number in those days, was 13. So what you were receiving was anywhere between 5 and 7% real rate of return. And believe me, no one knows it better than I, because I had some friends that got out of gold and into the bond market. Yours truly did not at the time. It was the best trade you could probably make for 30 years. Because as we both know, as yields go down, bond prices go up. So you've locked in, let's say, an 18% on a government bond. And now you get to ride that baby for 30 years collecting those kind of keep. Are you kidding? This is the greatest thing you could have possibly done. That has ended. So now this idea that, you know, interest rates are going to have an effect, they could, but that's only if you get a real rate of return. And I'll go on record, Jim. I think it's absolutely, totally, and completely impossible to raise the interest rates to a level where there is a true rate of return, meaning that the rate is greater than the true inflation rate, which you can take from shadow stats if you wish, probably, I don't know, 7%, something in that range. So anywhere like 7% or higher, it's impossible for the U.S. government to raise rates that high. Not that it couldn't happen, you know, in a bond collapse or in a debt bomb like I wrote about in the Silver Manifesto, but I don't see it wanting to get there on its own. It can't. It would be devastating to the debt and credit markets.
All right, let's move on to something else, and that's silver. Where do you see silver in this? As from the lows of the summer, it's up a little over a buck. Silver, when it moves, Dave, as you know, it can be very explosive. So how do you see silver fitting in here? Is it going to be dependent on a move in gold to take off, or is there some other driving factor that could drive silver prices up?
Wow, that's a great one. And here's my take right now, subject to change. And I don't like to be wishy-washy, but, you know, I've been in this market too long to not hedge my bets at times. When the bull market is in force, silver will lead gold. Now, I know it goes back and forth. I used to believe that silver always led, and I'll take that back. But at this point in time, silver is in a very tight range. It's called a channel formation. It's around the 1750 level, give or take a little bit. And this is a pattern that has explosive tendencies either up or down. So my take is that, one, the solar industry has become more important to China and India, and that the amount of silver used in the electronics is probably steady state or perhaps greater. I think there's a much bigger awareness of the silver as a, let's say, poor man's gold. So it's got the monetary aspect, and it's better known than probably any time in modern history. So I really think, because it's a smaller market, it's better known than any other time. And there is an industrial component of all about 50% of the entire market, that the demand side of the equation could go extreme almost overnight. So I certainly haven't given them a bullish stance on silver. And I really think that once it gets going, people tend to follow the momentum. So I'm looking for silver to possibly get back to the $20 range by the end of the year. But also, as I said earlier, you know, the probability to repeat a sell-off toward the end of the year is what we've seen the last several years. So you have to bear that in mind. I'm looking at the channel formation. And if we break to the upside, obviously we're going higher. There's no stopping it to about the 19-1950 range. If it breaks lower, the next level supports about 1650.
All right, let's look at something maybe longer term, Dave, and that is what a possible catalyst could be for the precious metals market. One that strikes me, and you're hearing this from both candidates running for president, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, have both talked about massive spending programs on infrastructure. And of course, Clinton is talking about other massive spending programs. Well, we're already running. The deficit is up 34% in the latest fiscal year. And so we're already up to $600 billion. Would a possible, let's say, stimulus program coming from Washington that would be monetized by the Fed be a catalyst for the movement in precious metals? I'm just trying to look out there. Other than a, let's say, a sudden financial crisis like the pig crisis that we had in 2011, or let's say a crisis in Asia, what is out there as a catalyst that would move the metals market?
Well, Jim, I'll come back to you. I mean, you're the one that wrote, I think, was silver waiting for a catalyst or something to that effect. It was a great piece, and I think everyone that hasn't read it or has read it should reread it. And, you know, what we've seen for the last, I don't know, decade or so is monetary policy. We really haven't seen any fiscal policy, and this is something that goes back to the QE2 and, you know, people didn't, maybe did or did not know, but they thought there'd probably be some fiscal stimulus, meaning the government spending money on infrastructure or whatever. And now that that's proposed by both candidates, I think it will be a catalyst. I think that once you are able to monetize this massive increase in money supply that's only in the debt markets and hasn't gone to Main Street, once that's able to go into the pockets of the general public, which means fiscal policy, some make-work projects, or maybe some worthwhile projects, that's for you and to determine for yourself. Regardless, once it starts getting in the pockets of the public, it depends on, you know, the flow rate, the velocity of money, all this other stuff. But the main idea is, wow, you're putting it into the pockets of the people. When that takes place, depending again on what the psychology is, it certainly could be a huge catalyst for people to wake up and say, oh, wow, look at this. The other side of that, Jim, is you could see a repatriation of the U.S. dollar. I mean, I think it's 2/3 of all physical currency resides overseas. And as this bond market situation becomes more tenuous, and I think it's already started, you might see a sell-off in the debt markets where that selling of a long-term debt turns into ready cash, and that cash is seeking a home of safety and it wants to buy something. So you could have also a flood of U.S. dollars coming back home, repatriating to buy something of value. I don't know what. It could be a lot of things. It could be real estate. It could be stocks. It could be gold and silver. It could be tangibles of some other type, commodities generally. So I think we have a twofold thing to think about. One is dollars flooding home because the markets at large are giving up on the ability of the U.S. to pay anything back of value, and also fiscal policy, which puts money into Main Street. And all of a sudden, at some point, Main Street wakes up and says, you know what? These dollars aren't buying as much as they used to. I need to put them somewhere that's going to do me some good.
You know, it's amazing because as I look forward, Dave, I see the bigger catalyst. And you've seen this come from the IMF, which is changing its tune, the World Bank, and the G20. Christine Lagarde is talking about we need to see fiscal spending, because I think there's a growing recognition that the influence of monetary policy is waning and it's not working effectively. We've seen it in Japan with negative interest rates, and we've seen it in Europe. So the next call is for fiscal spending. And given where governments are with their budget deficits as they are now, I think maybe the next catalyst, at least this is just my view, is going to come when we get into economic weakness, as it looks like we're heading in that direction. And then what governments do, they respond with massive fiscal spending, very much like we did coming out of the crisis in 2009. But this time, the Fed monetizes, or central banks monetize, the fiscal spending. So it's a way that government gets money into the economy, which can drive up prices, and the Fed simply prints, or a central bank prints, the money for it. But that's just my view. Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work you do at the Morgan Report, why don't you tell them how they could do so?
Great. Well, I've rebranded, as you know, Jim, to themorganreport.com. If you haven't gotten the Riches and Resources Report, I highly recommend you do. It's absolutely free. There's two movies in there, one on the decline of the Age of Empire, which is sort of a top level view that drills down at a pretty good level to what's really going on from a global perspective with the neoliberalism economic picture. Let me not be fancy. Basically, it tells you where we are and where we're going from a historic perspective. The other one is the question I probably get very often, which is, you know, what's it going to look like? And this is the movie that our friend Frank Barbera actually told me about, Jim, and it's called The Empty ATM. It's a documentary about the currency crisis in Argentina in 2000-2001. I won't elaborate on that. These are two films that you'll get in the Riches and Resources Report absolutely for free. And it's very, very beneficial to either help you revivify what you already know, and especially for those around you that you really care about that are still, let's say, awakening, but not fully awake. And this is my perspective, a very studied one, that the economy from a global or even a mainstream perspective is in a huge disarray. And we are facing some very interesting times going forward. So if you can get some education and pass it on to somebody that you care about, this would be something that I think would be very worthwhile.
William White is former chief economist for the Bank for International Settlements. He says that the easy money, which central banks have created, is now doing more harm than good. And he'll have a chance to enunciate his position as Chris Sheridan interviews William White coming up in The Big Picture during the next hour of the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.